Morning Show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we are going to be introducing you, if you don't know her already, to Katie Otsval, who is the executive director of KFASI. That is the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. Yeah, got it right, actually. I'm amazed. And more important than the name is the important work that this agency does. Katie was telling me before we went on the air that there are actually 19 different programs that KFASI offers to the Kenosha community. And they range all over the map, but really trying to help make life better, particularly those in our community who, for one way, reason or another, are facing exceptional burdens or challenges of one kind or another. And so we have a lot to talk about. So for part one of today's program, we welcome you, Katie Otsval, to the morning show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. You've been on the job for 3 years at KFASI. Tell us a little bit about where you come from and what you did before joining the agency 3 years ago.
Sure. I am originally from the southeastern Wisconsin area, and so it's good to be home. But for a few years, I had been working for a large multi-state nonprofit in Ohio. Prior to that, I was with Family Service of Racine. So KFASI has really been just a culmination of the skill sets and the opportunities I've had through the years, and it really feels good to be back home.
Hmm. So at what point in your life did this kind of work become important to you?
I suppose it's always been important. You know, I was raised in an environment where my family was very involved in nonprofit work throughout the community. Girl Scouts was a very important piece of my upbringing. And from a very early age, I've been a big sister mentor. So it's always really been important to me to give back to the community in a way that just feels very natural. So this work was just something I was really born to do from the get-go.
Sounds like it. KFASI is a lot to take care of with, you were telling me, a staff of 63 and an army of 700-plus volunteers. So it's a lot for you to take care of. What are your most specific responsibilities as executive director in keeping all of this together?
Well, I suppose some of my staff might say going to lunch, but that really is where a lot of the connections in the community happen and where I get to get out and meet with people who may not always be aware of all that CAFASI does and how important the work is to the community. Oftentimes with social service work, it happens behind the scenes, and until a family or an individual is in crisis, it's just something that is a fabric of our community, but not always something that in the Monday through Friday grind, people are aware of that happens and is so impactful and is so critical to any community's success. And so, again, being out and being able to network and spread the mission of CAFASI, I see as really my number one function in my role. But then as executive director, I get to be involved in really all the aspects of 19 different programs and getting to know our client base and our volunteers who are so critical to our services. Truly, our work can't happen without them. So just being part of everything that happens is really what, you know, I'm privileged enough to be involved in every day.
So under what auspices does CAFASI exist? And in a sense, who or what pays the bills?
CAFASI, like many independent non-for-profits, relies on the generosity of the community. So donors who are willing to invest in our mission and believe in the impact that we have on the community. Also, we contract with Kenosha County, very deep partnerships from our aging services all the way through our family services. And then we do have some federal contracts and other community-based grants or foundation grants that help offset some of our programming expenses. But I wanted to take an opportunity to mention that although CAFASI has just over a $3 million operating budget, it really is our volunteers who bring one of the greatest impacts in that this past year. So in 2015, we were able to quantify that our 707 volunteers, you know, really provided almost 50,000 hours of service. And that's over $1 million back into our community. So they help us leverage those county contracts, those grant funds, those foundation funds, and your donations as well as the community. They really, you know, enjoy the work they do, but also provide that financial impact. So they have a ripple effect far beyond our $3 million budget.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Otzval. She is the executive director of the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services, or CAFASI. She's been on the job for 3 years and oversees a staff of 63 and more than 700 active volunteers who help make make everything go. You were telling me that those 19 programs fall under essentially two categories, which are?
They are aging services and family services. Oftentimes, CAFASI is best known for our Meals on Wheels program. Meals on Wheels is a national program and incredibly important to so many vulnerable in our community and communities throughout the country, that Meals on Wheels as a standalone is often a household name. But that is just one component of what we do at CAFASI. Incredibly important. I don't mean to undermine that. But again, just one piece of what our staff and volunteers do every day.
Let's talk for a moment about who Meals on Wheels services. I mean, do you have to sort of qualify for it with a particular income level or demonstrate some other kind of need or difficulty? Or is this something essentially available to anybody?
Great question. Yeah, Meals on Wheels is a program designed for those 60 and older who are homebound, have difficulty getting out of the home, getting to the grocery store, difficulty maneuvering within their own living environment that makes preparing their meals difficult. And so Meals on Wheels brings a nutritious meal to their home every day, a hot meal at lunchtime, and can also provide cold and frozen meals for other times of the day and the weekend. But Meals on Wheels does have an income-based component because we never want somebody to be denied a nutritious meal. But then for those who don't necessarily meet the federal guidelines for the income requirements, the meals are available to anybody at $5.25 a meal. Hmm. That is our cost. So and that provides the meal and the delivery.
And where does the food come from?
We partner with a variety of vendors. One of our largest vendors is Hoffman House out of Batavia, Illinois, but also Kenosha Achievement Center and other vendors throughout Kenosha County.
So you're involved in the distribution.
Yes.
So people aren't cooking mashed potatoes in the back room of your
place. We coordinate the distribution. Other people are much more qualified than us to prepare those meals.
Right. And I should think that the contact between volunteers and those receiving these meals is nearly as important as the food itself.
And that is an excellent point. That's one thing we say about the meal service, as well as our senior dining program, is that it's more than a meal. It's a connection within the community. It's a safety check for our clients to make sure that they're feeling well and that they have the resources and, again, the connection within the community. That's so vital and just as important, if not more so, than the food itself.
You were telling me that another program that falls under the auspices of your of what you you do for the more aged members of our community involves early memory loss, and there are a couple of different things that you offer, including a program called Daybreak that is, in a sense, remarkably simple and yet makes, I'm sure, an absolutely extraordinary difference in the lives of a lot of caregivers who are really bearing a difficult burden. Tell us about Daybreak.
Thank you. As with all CAFASI programs, Daybreak serves throughout Kenosha County. So we have a site, Daybreak site out in Twin Lakes, as well as one within the city of Kenosha. And what Daybreak does is offer loved ones a chance to have some respite. So the caregiver drops the participant off at our Daybreak program. Our hours are 9:30 to 3:30, Monday through Friday. That participant is involved with things like brain games, exercise, crafts, meals and snacks are provided, all under the care of our Daybreak coordinators and, again, committed volunteers who make sure that that participant is in an environment that's consistent and loving and supportive. And so it is a pay-for-service program, but we have scholarship funds available and other federal funds that help offset some of that cost. So we like to let families know never to let that be a barrier. But our Daybreak program has been in operation for over 20 years now. So we really have been at the forefront of Alzheimer's and dementia care within our community. Early to mid stages are the ideal times. We like to get people involved in the program, but really we work with the family as long as possible to keep their loved one in the home, keep them independent, provide them the support they need. Hmm.
I know that also something you offer to the community is memory screenings, which for somebody might be a way to indicate or discover if they or a loved one is maybe beginning to exhibit some of the first signs of something that could be pointing to a more serious situation. I suppose that's really kind of a tricky thing. As we all get older, we tend to become more forgetful, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're on this inexorable slide towards dementia or something like Alzheimer's. What's the nature of these memory screenings, and when do they occur?
Yes, there is a natural component to aging, but there's also times to get checked out and take advantage of the opportunities within our community. This is an area in which we partner very deeply with Kenosha County and their Aging and Disability Resource Center, the ADRC, to be out there and to make Kenosha County a dementia-friendly community. The county has a staff member who goes into businesses and helps them devise ways to be dementia-friendly. We partner with them to offer virtual dementia tours. So that's an opportunity for folks like you or I or a caregiver to, you know, put on a pair of goggles, wear some gloves that kind of give you the loss of sensation in your fingertips, wear some earphones that are connected to an MP3 player, blasting different noises in your ears at different volumes while you are given a set of tasks to complete. And it really is an eye-opening experience to go through what, you know, so many in our community face with Alzheimer's and dementia. And while we're hosting the virtual dementia tours, which take about 30 minutes, they're a free opportunity within our community. We also offer the memory screening. So that's a chance for somebody who may be concerned to come in and have a professional sit with them and go through a series of questions and tests and give them the results and talk about options that are available in the community or, you know, where they may want to go next. Hmm.
And I suppose as our population ages, this is the kind of thing that becomes only more important, and you're making a bigger and bigger difference in our community.
It's absolutely critical. Kenosha County has a very large population of those 60 and older, and nationwide, you know, it's oftentimes called the silver tsunami, but as the baby boomers begin to enter retirement ages and all the things, the wonderful things, but then also some of the concerns that come along with that, you know, resources like CAFASI and the ADRC are available in our community. Kenosha County should be very proud of that. We do a phenomenal job of offering resources.
We're speaking with Katie Otsval, who is Executive Director of the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. And, of course, the difference you make in young families is also quite extraordinary. Explain the most important ways in which you reach out and lend support to people just starting families who might be starting those families at some sort of disadvantage.
Sure. Yes. As I spoke about earlier, oftentimes CAFASI is best known for our Meals on Wheels program or our aging services, but we have a very robust family service division, which in 2015 served over 1,000 families. And those families really range from those like you or I, who, you know, may be parents for the first time. We have a teen parent program and just a general family support program. I always say that parenting is, you know, part instinctual, but also a great part learned. And if you haven't had the life experience to learn those skills, you're at a disadvantage. So we want to prepare families and offer them as much knowledge as possible. We have a variety of things happening, but probably most importantly, we have workers at CAFASI who will go into the home and work with the entire family, observing, looking at the family dynamic, and offering suggestions, creating goals in partnership with the family as to maybe what they want to work on, what they'd like to see improve. And so those are very bonded relationships. One of our teen parent workers has already been in the delivery room 9 times this year. And just a great way for, again, families in our community to be connected, to not have to feel alone, to have access to the resources they need to raise their families in a way that keeps them independent and out of the system. On the other side of the spectrum, though, we do have some families who, you know, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, have entered into what we call the system. So they are affiliated with DCFS, which is Child and Family Services. And CAFASI, in connection, again, with Kenosha County, has a really innovative program, and we've really become the model within the state of Wisconsin for in-home safety services. And that program really is just something amazing to reduce trauma to the child by working with a family where there has been a substantiated case of abuse or neglect, but not removing that child from the family, allowing the child to stay within the family unit, keeping that child safe or children is definitely the most important. And we accomplish that while simultaneously working with the parent or parents to build those skills to ensure long-term safety. In the immediate, we have staff in connection with some other organizations in Kenosha County who do safety checks. Sometimes they're in the home up to 5-6 times a day. So really reducing the trauma to the child, but ensuring that they're safe. We have programs on the family service side from that intensive intervention all the way down to what I spoke about earlier, our preventative family support programs. So it's really a way for families to never have to feel alone within Kenosha County.
You mentioned that you had last year over 700 active volunteers. What is the most important work in which they are specifically engaged?
I don't know that I could necessarily pick one that is most important. We have volunteer opportunities that touch every single one of the 19 programs that we have at CAFASI. Volunteers are a critical aspect in all of the services that we provide. As an example, we have a volunteer transportation program that takes people 60 and older or those who are disabled to medical appointments, oftentimes life-saving cancer treatments and dialysis. And that does not happen without the commitment of volunteers who are willing to use their time and their own vehicle to get our communities most vulnerable to these life-saving appointments. Also, our Meals on Wheels program would not happen without over 30 volunteers every day. We have over 300 meals that go out throughout Kenosha County. And if we did not have drivers who were willing to pick up those meals at the meal sites and deliver, each route has about 10 stops on it. So it takes about an hour to an hour and a half. But again, just so critical. Oftentimes that visit, that meal being dropped off is the only interaction that that client has throughout the day. So again, just so much more than a meal. We have mentors in the schools through our RSVP program. We have companionship through our friendly visitor program. And the list goes on. But again, I just can't stress enough how meaningful our volunteers are and also how our work is not possible without them. So I encourage anybody listening who's ever maybe even thought of volunteering to give our offices a call. We take you through the process. We do a great job orientating. And there's such a need in our community, but it's a great way to be connected. And it's actually fun. It's great for you, too, as a volunteer.
Of course. Before we let you go, say a word about the special event that's coming up on the 9th of November.
Yeah, wonderful. We are really excited at CAFASI to be going into our 13th year of our Bowls and Bakers fundraiser. So it is a soup tasting contest that happens out at the Parkway Chateau. They are wonderful hosts for this event. And we have area restaurants, most oftentimes our friends west of the interstate, places like Driftwood and Luisa's and Bristol 45 Diner, who donate soup and come serve. And people attend for a cost of $25. And there's various bakery that's happening. There are raffles that are occurring. We're raffling off Packer Bear tickets this year, courtesy of our Meals on Wheels vendor, Hoffman House. And it just really is a fun afternoon. The event happens from 11 to 1, November 9th at Parkway Chateau. But it's also for a great cause. All the funds raised go back to supporting CAFASI programs and the work that we do.
So if people want more information about that or becoming a volunteer, give us the phone number and maybe also your website address.
Sure. Thank you. You can reach us at Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services, CAFASI, at www.cafasi, so it's K for Kenosha, A for area, F for family, A for and, S for service, I for inc.org. Otherwise, our office number is 658 3508. We're area code 262.
Very good. Katie Otzval is the executive director of the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. And my word, you have to take care of an awful lot, but it is impressive and gratifying to see so much great work being done in the community. So we applaud you and commend you and the good work of all of your volunteers and staff. And we appreciate you being with us on the morning show today.
Thank you so much. At Kafasi, it is absolutely our pleasure to serve, and we just appreciate any opportunity to talk about the work.
Very good. Thank you again. Part two of the morning show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. The time is 8:35. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. That music is, of course, from Star Trek, the groundbreaking science fiction series that debuted on network television on the 8th of September, back in 1966. So tomorrow night will mark the 50th anniversary to the day of when Star Trek was first seen by the American public on national television. In anticipation of tomorrow's anniversary, I want to play for you a portion of a conversation I recently recorded with Mark Cushman, the author of several extraordinary books about Star Trek called These Are the Voyages, in which he goes episode by episode through all three seasons and explains how each episode took shape. It's also a very, very intriguing look at behind the scenes of how Star Trek was created from the bottom up. In our last conversation, I asked him to recount the story of how he first encountered Star Trek almost 50 years ago.
I was a latecomer in that I didn't see the first episode until they were rerunning the first season, because I lived up in a town called Hebel, Oregon, and we were surrounded by mountains, and we got CBS and ABC from Portland. The NBC station only fizzled in during the summer months, and so everybody at my school, and I was in, I think, the third grade at that time, were watching Star Trek, and the teachers would even say, they'd start to give a homework assignment, and the class would moan, and they'd say, oh yeah, it's Thursday, it's Star Trek night, okay, no homework. And I thought, I don't know what this Star Trek is, but I'm liking it already. And then finally, I was watching Lost in Space and shows like that. And finally, I got to see it. And the first episode I saw during its second broadcast was Devil of the Dark, which was probably in the early summer months or midsummer months. And that was the one with the Horta, that they thought they were trying to kill a monster, and they found out that they had been killing its eggs, which was one of the things Star Trek always did. As they said, would show you that a monster is not necessarily a monster. Even a monster has reasons for what it does. And maybe we're the monsters in its eyes. And I'd never seen that type of a story told on a TV show before.
So you were hooked right from the start.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, and I had so many people telling me how great it was. So you go into something like that already convinced, but part of you is saying it can't be this good. Mm. From what everybody's saying, because these kids, third grade kids, were talking about this show, not just how exciting it was and how different it was, but they would come in and they'd start talking about things that they didn't know the word, but the word would be theme, the theme of the episodes, and the messages they had learned from the episodes. And they weren't communicating it that cleanly because they were young kids, but from what I heard them saying, and sometimes the teacher talking with them about last night's episode, that there's something more to this than to, say, Lost in Space or other shows, that there was something coming across more than just entertainment.
Right, and it wasn't about, oh, did you see the monster with the three heads and the purple trunk? It was not about the monsters at all. It was about these amazing stories.
Yeah, and a lot of credit to this teacher. I'll say her name was Mrs. Ruff, and up in Hable, Oregon, that she would engage the students in conversations about what did you get out of that episode. I'd never heard those type of conversations before. Flash forward many, many, many years later, I'm writing in Los Angeles as a writer, and I got to pitch to Star Trek The Next Generation, and Gene Roddenberry took the pitch, and I told him a story I wanted to tell, and you always start with the hook. And this one was what happens to a Vulcan when he goes through senility. It became the episode Sarek on Next Generation. And I hooked him with this idea. But before he said, go write it, he said, okay, what do you want to say with this story? And that's when I realized why every episode of Star Trek had this extra thing in there, because it was important to him that the writer was trying to communicate something, not just entertain us.
You've already mentioned the name of another science fiction TV series that was actually already on the air when Star Trek debuted 50 years ago. We're talking about Lost in Space. And I know that you mentioned to me as we set up this interview we're recording right now that you said, in your words, you're on house arrest right now, anchored to your desk at home, trying to finish up a new book you are crafting about Irwin Allen, who is a big name when it comes to science fiction, particularly on television. So this is probably as good a time as any to talk briefly about this other series, Lost in Space, and to draw a contrast between it and Star Trek.
And there's a huge contrast, but also, if it wasn't for Lost in Space, there wouldn't have been a Star Trek, as I found out with my research for this new book. By the way, the first volume is out. It came out a few weeks ago, but it's a two-book set because it also covers Irwin Allen's early career and everything that led up to him being able to do Lost in Space, because a show like that had never been done on TV until a year later Star Trek comes along. So it covers a lot of ground and gives you a lot of information about what was going on in the world at that time, what was going on in the TV industry, to where the networks were resistant to the idea of an hour-long science fiction series with continuing characters that goes into outer space and all that. He was the pioneer who broke through that barrier. And he and Gene Roddenberry were in a race. They both shot their pilots during the same week.
Wow.
Two weeks. So the day that the Star Trek pilot started shooting, the Lost in Space pilot started shooting. And they both took more than 14 days. They both went over schedule. They both went over budget. But Irwin got Lost in Space on the year before because NBC wanted a second pilot on Star Trek, and they were still resistant to put it on the air until they saw that Lost in Space was winning its time slot. And Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea was winning its time slot, which was also an Irwin Allen show, and that was on ABC. So NBC felt, well, we need to get into the game. And that's why we got Star Trek. So God bless you, Irwin Allen.
Yeah. I'm anxious to see your books about Irwin Allen and about Lost in Space. Not that I was ever a huge Lost in Space fan, but I certainly watched it. And I think one of the things that I'm sure we will come away from as we read those books, and maybe you and I can even have an interview about them, is that Lost in Space is very easy to dismiss out of hand as an entirely inferior series, not at all serious in any way. And that may be due to the fact that many people most vividly remember what Lost in Space became. To just talk for a moment about, in a sense, the decline in seriousness that occurred over the course of that series as it also shifted from black and white into vibrant technicolor.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to do the book on Lost in Space, and the reason it became a two-book set, as I said, is it covers Irwin Allen's early life as well, but it was a richer story than I expected to find. And when we did the Star Trek books, it was supposed to be one book, but it was a richer story than we expected to find. We thought, well, we know everything there is to know about Star Trek. No, we knew nothing about Star Trek, because what I do with these books, and I Spy included, is they're authorized books in the fact that I get permission to go through all the show files, all the memos, all the documents pertaining to writing the episodes, producing the episodes, as you had mentioned earlier, and even the first broadcast, what the ratings were. So you get the ratings reports for every episode on Star Trek, and it's broken through so much folklore where people, NBC said it didn't do well on the network. It was their top-rated Thursday night show. They moved it to Friday. It was their top-rated Friday night show. So why did they cancel it? Well, when we get back to Star Trek, I'll answer that question. But Lost in Space was a hit right out the gate, and so was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. So Irwin Allen went to the networks and said, I want to do an hour-long TV show and get it on there. They said, you can't do this. You can't, on a TV budget, we're only giving you $120,000 an episode. You can't, which was the average back then. They said, you can't do the photographic effects that you want to do. You can't create the futuristic costumes, the spaceships, or the submarines, or all this type of stuff. And he got ABC because he said, I don't have to create any of that stuff. We did it for a movie, and I saved everything. I saved the Sea View, and we had three models. One's 24 feet long, and then we had two that each one was a little bit smaller, depending on what they needed to use it for. I saved the uniforms. I saved the interior sets. We have a lot of stock footage we shot that we never put into the movie. And you can have all that for free. I need a little more than 120 grand. How about 125 grand per episode? And so ABC decided to take a chance. Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea premiered in the fall of 1964, an immediate hit. And it was killing the competition on CBS. CBS had always won Monday nights, and suddenly they're in third place because of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, getting all the kids away and their parents. And so CBS went to him and said, give us one. And he came up with Lost in Space. Well, that was even more of a gamble than Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, because that's taken us into outer space. And the photographic effects would even be more challenging. Everything he was going to do was going to be more challenging. So he got a slightly higher budget. It was about $135 an episode, which was very expensive in those days for TV. And he did it, and he got it on the air. But just like Star Trek, when you go through the memos and the production reports, he fell behind schedule. They would go over budget. They'd be delivering an episode to the network days before it was supposed to be aired. And so it was a...
This is a test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
But the networks weren't ready to give it to us. Our parents weren't necessarily ready for us to see it. And so the show started off very dark, almost film noirish if you watch it. The photography... you have this character, Dr. Smith, who sneaks aboard the ship and sabotages it and then gets trapped on it and can't get off. And he programs the robot to kill everybody but the pilot because he needs the pilot to get back home. He programs the robot to kill the children. He tells them after they crash land on this planet, he says, whenever you find any of them alone, get rid of them and make it look like an accident. Now, this is dark, dark, heavy stuff for the family hour in 1965. And so CBS said, you're going too far with this. You can't put children in peril. And so they said, get rid of Dr. Smith. Dismantle the robot. Quit doing these type of stories. And so what they had to do to keep Dr. Smith, keep the robot, is they had to lighten the show up. They had to start changing the characters, making them less of a threat, and so forth. So he was dealing with the network and what he was allowed to do in that time slot, and that's why there was such a big difference between Star Trek and Lost in Space, because one came on an hour later.
And it is a wonderful concept, and if treated seriously, it actually could have certainly given way to an absolutely superlative show. And, of course, it turned into something else, a different sort of phenomenon. And
Irwin, and nobody was, well, we fans who were watching it, us 8, 9, and 10-year-old kids who had never seen anything like this on TV. You look at those first episodes of Lost in Space, and they're epic with the takeoff, the sabotage, the crash landing. I mean, the effects were beyond belief for television, and really better than anything we'd seen in the movies.
Hmm.
This is way before 2001, A Space Odyssey. And so nobody was more bothered than us, the young fans, than Irwin Allen, because that's the show he wanted to make. He always directed his pilots, and he wanted it to be grim. He wanted it to be man against man, man against the elements. Swiss Family Robinson, marooned, but in outer space, Space Family Robinson. And so when he had to change the show, he started losing interest in it and started focusing more on his other shows, like Time Tunnel and trying to create Land of the Giants, because all of his other shows were serious. Lost in Space was the only one who became like a comedy, but that was the network that wanted it that way. They said, look, we have nothing but comedies on this night. You lead into the Beverly Hillbillies. It goes into Green Acres. That goes into the Dick Van Dyke Show. We don't, you know, people don't want to get up and change channels. There's nothing like remote controls back then. Let's give them a night of shows that seem to fit together. So they pushed him and pushed him to keep changing the show.
Hmm. We're speaking with Mark Cushman, and he has written a book about Irwin Allen, the creator of, among other things, Lost in Space. But we're here primarily to talk about Star Trek, the original series. 50 years ago, on the 8th of September, 1966, Star Trek aired its first episode on NBC. And, of course, an unprecedented television phenomenon was born. And Mark Cushman has written three thoroughly researched books called These Are the Voyages, each devoted to each of the three seasons of the original series. Mark Cushman, I noticed for the first time as I took out these books this morning, and I've read these cover to cover more than once, but in all my reading of them, I never noticed the words right above the title on the cover, These Are the Voyages. It says above that, "The Story Gene Roddenberry and Robert H. Justman Wanted You to Know." What do you mean by those few words there?
Those two men helped make these books possible. Gene Roddenberry, when I met him and knew him over at Next Generation, I interviewed him as well for a local Los Angeles TV show about Star Trek and how huge it was becoming. And his co-producer, Bob Justman, that I met a few years later. And they were the two that really opened the doors for me, who gave me all the show files, which now a lot of them are parked over at UCLA Special Collections Library. So if a fan is visiting Los Angeles and they can go in during the hours that it's available, they can sit there and go through these things. It's a lot. It's like 40 boxes. And there's a couple of different files on every single episode, and you're seeing all these memos. So it would have to be a very long vacation to get through it all. But Gene and Bob opened up all these files to me and even gave me a lot of stuff that isn't at UCLA, as well as interviews and so forth. And the way it started is I told Gene that when I was a kid growing up, there was a book out called The Making of Star Trek by Stephen Whitfield. And it told about the pilots and getting the show on the air and started giving you examples of how the show was being made. But it didn't go into the episodes deeply, or even any specific episodes other than the first pilots. And I said, did you save all the documents for those two? And he says, oh, we got everything. And so when I heard that, I said, I want to bring this to everybody. So yes, it says written by Mark Cushman, but I had co-writers in this. I had co-writers in the sense that you're reading all these memos from Gene Roddenberry and Bob Justman and Dorothy Fontana and Gene L. Kuhn, all the producers and producer writers on the show. And the network, Stan Robertson at the network. And so there's a lot of their words in these books, because what I do is I take you back in time, drop you in a chair, and you're in a room surrounded by these people as they talk about each episode that they're making. And it really feels that way. Did it feel that to you?
Absolutely. And it's interesting, too, a parallel. It was Star Trek itself was not an easy sell to the networks. And I should think these books were maybe not an easy sell to a publisher. I mean, you had to persuade the folks at Jacobs Brown, who eventually published these books, that these books would be greedily snapped up by Star Trek fans. I mean, all kinds of books have been written about the series before, but never anything like this. And you had to help them understand how these books would be different and the kind of void that it would be filling, even though, you know, just at a casual glance, there's no such thing as a void in the world of Star Trek with all the books that have been written, but nothing like this had been written.
Yeah, and I kept hoping somebody would write these books because I was working as a screenwriter and sometimes a director, and I thought, well, this is going to be a lot of years of my life to write, to do this, what I want to do. And I was hoping somebody else would do it, and it didn't come along. So I finally said, well, I'm going to have to, because I interviewed Gene way back in the late 80s on this, mid-80s first time, and then again in the late 80s or right around 1990, and then I started interviewing Bob and Dorothy and all the others and John D.F. Black and so forth, and then getting to the guest stars and the directors and everybody that worked on these shows. And I had all these memos. So I had all this material. And I said, sooner or later, I got to sit down and start doing this, putting it all together. And I knew it was going to take years. And I was actually signed with another publisher, and they wanted the books. And it was supposed to be one book, and I called the publisher, and I said, you know, it's really running long. This is going to be a big, big, big book. And he said, we'll send us some chapters, and we'll see how we can make it smaller. They read the chapters, and they said, no, keep going. This is great. And so I said, well, then it's going to have to be two books. And I said, then we'll make it two books. But they failed to get the book, first book out, and my contract expired. And Robert Jacobs, Jacobs Brown said to me, well, I'll get it out in 6 months, and most publishers take a year and a half. And he was the one who said, let it be three. Two feels weird. It was three seasons. What about a book for each season? So that gave me permission to do deeper research, put in more of the things I was finding, more of the documents and more of the memos, which are so fun to read. And so we were able to do it. And each season of Star Trek had different challenges they had to fight. It got harder and harder to make that show. So when you read the three books, and you can tell your listeners if this is true or not for you, but it's like a movie, and a movie gets more dramatic as it goes along. And as a writer, and I'm sure you've heard the expression, we write movies in a three-act structure. Act one, act two, act three, which creates the arc of the story and the arc of what the characters are going through. So we now have a three-act structure in three volumes.
Hmm.
The first Star Trek series, and what a dramatic story it was, at the battles they fought on every episode.
Hmm. And not just sort of, it's even beyond just the creative gauntlet of conceiving of this entirely different universe and then bringing it to life just artistically. That would be a significant challenge in and of itself, let alone when you are confronting the technical limitations of the day and the pessimism of your network and budgetary realities. I mean, what they managed to accomplish is nothing short of miraculous. I wonder
you made an interesting comparison several minutes ago when we were talking about Lost in Space briefly, and you said how different the two shows were and how much more important Star Trek was. Well, the time slot had a lot to do with it. The budget had a lot to do with it. Star Trek had a much bigger budget. It was one of the two most expensive shows in production during that time period. The other was I Spy, because they were filming around the world. And I know all this because I wrote that book on I Spy, too. But the big reason for the difference, even beyond the time slot, I mean, if Star Trek was on at 7:30 at night, they wouldn't have been able to tell the type of stories they were. But the big difference is that Gene Roddenberry wanted to be the Jonathan Swift of television. He wanted to tell stories about social unrest, about racism, about sexism, about God, about Vietnam. And Irwin Allen didn't. Irwin Allen wanted to entertain. He wanted to tell man-against-man stories, but it wasn't important to him to take his stories out of the headlines. Gene Roddenberry did. And that was the big battle between Gene and NBC, because back then you weren't supposed to do that. You weren't supposed to make commentary on entertainment TV shows. That was left for the news division. You weren't supposed to touch hot subjects on entertainment TV shows. They were supposed to entertain, not challenge the viewers or possibly alienate the viewers. And so Roddenberry was doing things that nobody had ever seen before on television. And that's one of the things why these episodes resonate still today, besides being a great cast, besides being a great concept of a military ship that's also a scientific investigation ship out there in the middle of nowhere by itself in the future, and it can go to any planet, it can come across any situation. But it was those themes that he would put in there, and those subjects that we would feel.
Mark Cushman, he is the author of this trilogy of fascinating books called These Are the Voyages. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, which is exactly the 50th anniversary to the day of Star Trek's premiere on network television, on that anniversary day, I'm thrilled to be able to share with you a conversation I recorded with one of the only creators of Star Trek who is still alive, a woman by the name of Dorothy Fontana. She was a secretary for Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, and she ultimately became one of the show's story editors and is responsible for writing several of the most memorable episodes of the series. You will hear my conversation with Dorothy Fontana and more from Mark Cushman on tomorrow's Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.